distance to be most interesting.
Is that why you're here? I asked.
Vapor was silent for a moment. Why do you ask?
I mean, it's nothing. Just, you know, the others tell me that your kind usually has very specialized missions.
We are not assassins, she answered. Those rumors are false, and the flight should not spread them. We are servants of the superiority.
Sure, sure, I said, surprised at the forcefulness in her voice. Maybe the team has been chattering too much. I'll run them through a few more exercises today. Shut them up the old military way. Make them too tired to gossip.
No, Vapor said, her voice softening. No need to bear the scent of smoke, Alenik. Just ask them not to theorize on my mission. I am not here to kill anyone. I promise that.
Understood, sir, I said. That only made her sigh, a sound like a soft breeze riffling papers.
I will take Braid out for a practice run. Please rest.
Confirmed, I said. And she took off, ordering Braid to join her. I opened my backpack, which I kept stowed in its tied-on position behind my seat, and got out a snack. I believed that Vapor wasn't here to kill anyone. But what was she here to do? I could swear I'd smelled her scents watching over my shoulder at times, and her race, did they see like others? I doubted it. But could she smell what I really was? Scud. I was already doing what she'd asked me not to do. If she knew what I was, she hadn't turned me in yet, so there was no use in worrying. I pointed my ship away from where the others were dogfighting, looking instead out at the stars. The field of light stared back at me, endless, inviting. I couldn't hear much from them. There was a small stream of cytonic communication, leaving the weights and measures, likely heading back towards Starsight, but it was a lot quieter out here than it was back near the enormous platform. All those stars, I thought, wondering if Detritus' sun was visible to the naked eye from this distance. Many of the planets around them inhabited, billions and billions of people. I closed my eyes, letting myself drift, just out here among the stars, floating. Almost without thinking, I undid my straps, hit the control lock on my console, and released myself to the zero-G of my cockpit. It was small confines, but with my eyes closed, I could truly just float. I pulled off my helmet and let it drift away to thump softly against the canopy. Me and the stars. Always before, I'd done Grand Grand's exercise when on the ground, in places where I needed to imagine that I was soaring among the stars, seeking their voices. For the first time, I truly felt that I was among them. Almost as if I were a star myself, a point of warmth and fire amid the endless night. I lightly pushed off the side of my canopy, keeping myself floating in the center, feeling. There, I thought. Starsight is over there. I knew instinctively the direction toward the platform. During our jumps between the Delver Maze and the city, my mind had been injected somehow with that knowledge. Each time, the imprint seemed to last longer, to the point where it was firm in my mind now, and no longer fading. If I had to, I knew I could hyperjump back to Starsight on my own. In fact, I was increasingly certain I could now find my way back to Starsight from anywhere. That didn't do me any good at the moment, though. I already had transportation to Starsight. My concentration receded as my problems seized my brain. Steal the superiority's hyperdrive technology. Rescue Braid. Figure out what was up with Vapor, not to mention the weapon the superiority was developing. And that didn't even get into the subtleties of whatever political situation was going on among Kuna, Winzik, and the Krell. It was all just so overwhelming. Spensa. A voice seemed to speak from out there, among the stars. Spensa.
soul of a warrior.
I snapped my eyes open, gasping. Gran-Gran? I said. I pushed my feet down against my seat, pressing myself against the window of my canopy, looking frantically out among the stars. Saints and stars. That had been her voice. Gran-Gran, I shouted.
Fight.
I will fight, Gran-Gran, I said. But what? How? I'm not right for this mission. It isn't what I trained for. I don't know what to do.
A hero does not choose her trials, Spensa.
Gran-Gran? I asked, trying to pinpoint the location of the words.
She steps into the darkness, the voice said, fading. Then she faces what comes next.
I searched desperately for my home among the thousands of stars, but it was hopeless, and whatever it was I thought I'd heard did not return. Just that lingering phantom echo in my mind. A hero does not choose her trials. I drifted for a long moment, hair floating in a mess around my face. Finally, I pushed myself down and buckled back into my seat. I tucked up my hair, then pulled on my helmet and strapped it in place. When further cytonic reaching didn't do anything, I sighed and focused on my flight. I should probably be evaluating their performances anyway, Vapor might ask. Braid and Vapor were both doing well, as could be expected. They were the two best pilots of the group, excluding me. But Hesho and his Kitson were also performing admirably. During this week of training, they'd really learned how to cover a wingmate and how to blend their role as a gunship with the need to sometimes just be a fighter, dogfighting like any other ship. Mortimer, though. Poor Mortimer. It wasn't their fault that they were the weakest pilot in our group. They were only a few months old, after all. And even if they'd inherited some skill from one of their parents, that smidgen of combat experience only made their mistakes more obvious. As I watched, they pulled too far ahead of Hesho and left the Kitson to be swarmed by enemies. Then, when trying to compensate and come back, Mortimer's shots missed the enemy and nearly brought down the Kitson ship's shields. I winced and opened a comm channel to chew out Mortimer. I immediately heard a string of curses that my translator helpfully interpreted for me. And Scud, even Gran-Gran hadn't been able to swear that eloquently. Which parent did you get that from? I asked over the channel. Mortimer immediately cut off. I could practically hear the blush in their voice as they replied.
Sorry, Alanik. I didn't know you were listening.
You're trying too hard, I advised them, overcompensating for your lack of skill. Relax.
It's easy to say that, they replied, when you have an entire life to live. I've only got a few months to prove myself.
You'll prove nothing if you shoot down a wingmate, I told them. Relax. You can't force yourself to become a better pilot through sheer determination. Trust me, I've tried. They acknowledged, and I think they did better during the next run, so hopefully my advice was working. Soon the practice runs ended, the embers pulling back to the Delver maze. My four flightmates joined me in a line. In the distance, I could see other flights practicing. To my amusement, it seemed that several others had pulled back from doing runs through the maze and were now practicing their dogfighting as well. I suspected we'd had a good influence on them. Don't pat yourself on the back too much, Spensa, I told myself. These are Krell ships. Even if they're training to fight Delvers now, you know they'll inevitably end up on the other side of a fight from the humans. That knowledge subdued my enthusiasm. That was a nice run, I told the rest of my flight. Yes, even yours, Mortimer. Vapor, I think this lot is starting to actually look like pilots.
Perhaps, Vapor replied. As they are excelling at your training, maybe we could let them have a chance at the maze. We should have time for one extended run today before training is finished.
About time, Hesho said. I am a patient, Kitson, but a knife can only be sharpened so far before all you are doing is wearing it away.
I smiled, remembering my own enthusiasm when Cobb had first started letting us train with weapons. Let's pair off, I said to Vapor, and do a run. Three of us will have to go as a trio, though, as we have five. I don't need a wingmate, Braid said, then turned and boosted toward the maze. I sat in stunned silence. She'd been getting better throughout the week. I thought she was beyond this now. Scud. That was the sort of stunt that would have made Cobb scream at us until he was red in the face. Braid, I shouted into the comm. So help me, if you don't return, I'll...
Let her go, Vapor cut in.
But we're always supposed to take a wingmate into the maze, I said. Otherwise, the illusions will fool you.
Then let her learn this lesson, Vapor said. She will see for herself when the rest of us perform better than she does.
I grumbled, but held myself back, barely, from continuing to rant at Braid. Vapor was our commander, even if I was the XO.
I will take Mormor, Vapor told me. I believe that I can help teach them a little patience. They need to learn to handle their aggression.
That puts me with Hesho, I said. We'll meet back here in an hour and a half. Fly in for 45 minutes, start accustoming yourself to the strange ways of the place, then fly back out.
Very well. Good luck.
Vapor and Mormor moved off, while Hesho commanded his helmsman to guide the Kitson ship up beside mine. Does it strike you as odd? I asked him. That we complain about Mormor being aggressive right after Braid flew off on her own? Mormor is a fair bit less aggressive than I am. Even less than you are, I'd say.
Mormor is not a member of a lesser species, Hesho said. Others expect more of them because of the vaunted primary intelligence their species has.
I've never understood that, I said, as the two of us flew inward, picking a different section to attack from Vapor and Mormor. The Delver maze was so big that wasn't a problem. What does primary intelligence even mean?
It is just a term, not an actual measure of their relative intelligence, Hesho said. From what I've been able to gather, it means their species has created a peaceful society, where crime is reduced to near non-existence.
I sniffed. Peaceful society? I didn't buy that for a moment. And if I had ever been inclined to, Alanik's last words would have disabused me. Don't trust their peace. Hesho and I approached the Delver maze, and I smothered the feelings of concern that rose inside me. Last time I'd gone in here, it had been a very strange experience. But I could handle that. A hero didn't pick her trials. You and your crew ready? I asked Hesho as the first of the embers neared us.
The swims upstream is ready for action, Captain, Hesho said. This moment, it awaits us like the tongue awaits the wine.
We fought our way through the embers. Then, side by side, the two of us swooped in through one of the many holes in our section of the Delver maze. I hugged the Kitson's larger, more heavily shielded ship as we entered a long steel tunnel ribbed with pillar-like folds at periodic intervals. There were no internal lights, so we turned on our floods.
Sensor department, Hesho said to his team. Get a close-up shot of those symbols on the wall.
Roger,
another Kitson said. I drifted to the side, shining my lights on another field of strange writing etched into the wall here.
We can't translate them, your normalness, said Cowrie. But the symbols are similar to ones found near nowhere portals on some planets and stations.
Nowhere portals? I asked, frowning.
Many people have tried to study the Delvers in their own realm, Captain, Hesho said. Cowrie, explain, if you please.
Nowhere portals are stable openings, Cowrie said, like wormholes leading into the nowhere. They are often marked by similar symbols. These portals are how Acclivity Stone is mined and transported to our realm. But I don't know why the symbols would be here. I see no sign of a portal.
Huh. I pulled my ship right up to the symbols, shining my floodlights on them. I saw some of these symbols back on my homeworld, I said, inside a tunnel near my home.
Then I should like to visit and see that, Cowrie said. It's possible your home has access to an unknown nowhere portal. That could bring riches. The Superiority keeps very careful control over their nowhere portals, as there is no other source of Acclivity Stone.
Huh. I didn't say more because I didn't want to give away the truth, that these writings had been in the caverns on Detritus, not Alanique's homeworld. The old inhabitants of Detritus had fallen to the Delvers, and I was increasingly certain that what Kuna had told me was right. The people of Detritus had courted that destruction by trying to control the Delvers. They'd set up shielding, had tried to be quiet, but none of their precautions had worked. When the Delver had come for the people of Detritus, it had easily bypassed their protections. The tunnel around me suddenly looked like it had turned into flesh. It was as if I were in the veins of some enormous beast. I gritted my teeth. Hesho, what do you see?
The tunnel has changed, he said, to feeling like it is submerged. Do you see this? It is a strange experience.
I feel like I'm in an enormous vein, I said. It's a hologram, an illusion, remember?
Yes, Hesho said. We are shown different things. Thankfully, we have two ships.
I wondered how Braid was doing in here by herself.
The illusion is curious, Hesho said. I feel like a stone plucked from land and dropped to sink endlessly into an eternal deep.
He paused.
My crew sees the same thing that I do, Captain Alanique.
That makes sense, I said. Our ships are programmed to replicate the illusions of the Delver Maze. For us right now, it's just programming. If this were real, you'd probably all see something different. At least, that was what I'd been told to expect. Only it seemed that much of what the Superiority knew was really guesswork. If I entered a real Delver Maze, would the same rules actually hold there? Hopefully you'll never have to find out, I thought. Hesho and I took the right-hand exit and flew through a corridor that appeared to me to be crystalline, but Hesho saw flames. Both of us, however, saw a large boulder at one side of the room, so we flew over and inspected it. A tug on it with a light lance proved it was real, and it tumbled out into the room.
How odd, Hesho said. Did someone come and install that boulder specifically to hinder our path?
Supposedly, I said, this maze is built to replicate the kind of oddities and mysteries we'll find inside the real Delver Maze.
Our scanners are useless, Hesho said. I have reports from my instruments teams, and they can't tell what's fake and what isn't. It seems that the Superiority has programmed our ship to be fooled by this place, something I find disconcerting. I don't like the idea of seeing what the Superiority shows me, even if it is for an important training simulation.
As we flew deeper, I was glad to have the Kitsun with me. Bringing a wingmate made all kinds of practical sense, not just for identifying what was real. On a more basic level, it was comforting to have someone to talk to in this place. We passed through several other strange rooms with a variety of odd visuals, from the walls melting to the shadows of enormous beasts passing just out of sight. We were attacked by embers in one, which I fired upon, before realizing Hesho couldn't see them. My shots hit the wall, blasting off pieces of metal, and the entire structure rumbled in a way that I could swear was threatening.
How can we hear that? Hesho asked. Instruments report a vacuum outside the ships. There is no medium for sound to pass through.
I shivered. Let's try that tunnel over there.
I don't like this,
Hesho confided, as we moved down the tunnel.
It feels like it's training us to rely upon one another's eyes.
That's a good thing, though, right?
Not necessarily, Hesho said. While all experience is subjective, and all reality in some ways an illusion, this offers a practical danger. If we come to rely upon consensus to determine what is real, the maze could simply exploit this assumption and trick us.
In the next chamber, we were attacked by embers that were real this time, and I almost ignored them, a mistake that could have been deadly. I responded to Hesho's warning at the last moment, dodging as a barrage from the heavily armed fighter vaporized them. We were left in a room with junk bouncing around and hitting the walls before starting to pool toward the bottom. Sweating, my heart thumping, I led us through the next passage. Scud, was I ever going to get used to this place? We reached the end of the tunnel, and my floods shone on a strange membrane covering the opening. It ran from the floor to the ceiling and pulsed softly with a rhythm I could hear. That sound suddenly seemed to ring through the entire structure. My fighter thumped under my fingers. I stared at the membrane, shocked. We'd only been in the Delver maze for, what, half an hour? Maybe a little longer? I'd expected it to take hours upon hours to find the heart. "That's it," I said. "The membrane. The thing we're looking for, the heart of the Delver."
"What?" Hesho said. "I don't see anything."
"Oh." I took a deep breath, calming myself. An illusion, which meant I saw the entire universe. In a blink, everything vanished around me, and somehow my mind expanded. I saw planets. I saw star systems. I saw galaxies. I saw the scrambling, useless, tiny little insects that covered them like chittering hives. I felt revulsion, hatred for these pests that infested the worlds. Hordes of ants swarming on a dropped piece of food, buzzing and mindless, disgusting, painful, as they'd swarm me, occasionally biting, for though they were too small to ever truly destroy me, they hurt. Their noise, their painful scraping. They infested my home after swarming all of the rocks that broke the endless nothing that was this universe. They would not ever leave me alone, and I wanted so badly just to smash them, to smother them beneath my foot so they'd stop piling and crawling and clicking and snapping and biting and corrupting and... I snapped back into my cockpit, slamming against my seat as if I'd been thrown there.
"Another illusion, then,"
Hesho said, sounding bored.
"You want to move forward first? I'll cover you, in case further embers guard this chamber."
I trembled, the horrible vision resting on me like the darkness in a cavern far, far underground. I breathed in gasps, trying to recapture my breath. The room looked normal to me now, but...
"Captain Alanik," Hesho asked.
What had that been? Why did it linger in my mind, making me revile Hesho's words as if they were coming from something slimy and horrible? I said. "Sorry, I need a moment." He gave it to me. I recovered slowly. Scud. Scud. That had felt like Vapor had said the Delvers regarded all of us. "Flight Command," I said, calling in. "Did you just show me something strange?"
"Pilot,"
Flight Command called back.
"You need to learn to fly the maze without contacting us. When you enter one for real, you won't..."
"What did you just show me?" I demanded.
"The log indicates that your ship's illusion for that room is of darkness hiding an exit. That is all."
So... they hadn't shown me that sensation of the universe? Of course they hadn't. That was far beyond the powers of a holographic projector. I'd seen something else. Something that my own mind had projected. Scud, what was I? At Hesho's urging, we continued and spent another 15 minutes moving through rooms, familiarizing ourselves with the way the maze worked. I didn't experience anything else approaching the feeling of that strange moment when I'd seen the universe. Eventually, we hit our predetermined exploration time limit, and so we turned around and flew back. Outside, we found the others gathering, including a furious Braid, who, as Vapor had guessed, had gotten stuck in one of the early rooms, unable to tell what was real and what wasn't. None of them had seen any membranes or had any idea what I was trying to explain when I tried, and failed, to talk about what I'd seen. I couldn't put it into words, but it remained with me, like a shadow over my shoulder, lingering as we reported back to the weights and measures. Chapter 26. We entered the nowhere. As always, it started with a scream. Absolute darkness, broken by the eyes. White hot, they stared in the wrong direction. The more often I did this, the more I could sense the shadow of what they were. Enormous, mind-bending things whose shapes didn't conform to my understanding of how physical forms should work. I seemed to hang there for an eternity. Aside from Braid, who wouldn't talk about it, the others of my flight said they didn't sense any time at all passing in the nowhere. To them, the hyperjump happened instantaneously. They never saw the darkness or the eyes. Finally, I felt the end coming on, a subtle, fading sensation that one of the eyes turned and stared right at me. The weights and measures popped back into regular space outside of Starsight. I gasped, my pulse going crazy, battle senses coming alert. It had seen me. One of them had looked right at me. We were traveling back to Starsight after another day of training, my 10th so far in the military here. I was extra tired today from putting the others through their exercises. Was that why it had seen me? What had I done? What was wrong?
Captain Alanik, Hesho said. Though I am not familiar with your species, you do seem to be exhibiting some traditional signs of distress.
I glanced down at the kitson. Hesho's ship engineers had transformed several of the jump room seats into kitson travel stations. Basically, little buildings several stories high, secured to the wall and complete with smaller seats inside for their whole crew. They chattered together inside the open-walled structures, though Hesho had the roof all for himself and his servants. It was about eye level for me, and was set with a luxurious captain's chair. It also had a bar and several monitors for entertainment, which seemed a ridiculous amount of luxury for the short half hour or so we spent on the weights and measures each day, flying out of and back to Starsight.
Alanik? Hesho asked. I can call my ship's surgeon, who is here below. She has little experience with alien species, however. How many hearts do you have?
I'm fine, Hesho, I said. Just a sudden chill. He said, leaning back in his seat and putting his feet up.
A moment of frailty in an otherwise powerful warrior. This is a beautiful moment, which I shall treasure.
He nodded to himself, then sighed and tapped a blinking button on his armrest, causing a screen to rotate toward him. We weren't supposed to use wireless communications except in emergencies. Hesho, however, had a loose definition of the word emergency, and he had been granted, upon persistent request, a bypass for the anti-communication shield around the weights and measures. It probably wasn't polite to listen in. At the same time, he was sitting right next to me, and my pin translated and transmitted the words to my earpiece, whether I wanted it to or not. A kitson appeared on his screen, a female, judging by the pattern of light and dark fur, wearing a very formal-looking outfit of colorful silk with matching headdress. She bowed to Hesho.
Unexalted one who is not king, she said. I have called to request guidance upon my vote tomorrow in the matter of the National Taxation Fund.
Hesho rubbed the fur underneath his snout.
I fear this is not working, Senator Arya. When I spoke to our monitors at the Superiority, they claimed that I was still having undue influence upon the functioning of our Senate.
The senator looked up.
But, unexalted one, the Senate voted exactly the opposite of your expressed preference.
Yes, and they did well, he said. But the Superiority seems to think that I simply told you to vote opposite my desires, and therefore continue to manipulate you.
A difficult situation, Senator Arya said. How would you like us to proceed?
Well, Hesho said, it seems the superiority would very much like you to choose what you would like.
My greatest desire in all of the universe is to see the king's will made manifest.
And if his will is for you to be yourself?
Of course. Which type of myself would you like?
Perhaps choose randomly how you vote each time, Hesho said. Do you think that would work?
Certainly. In that case, the superiority cannot claim we are being influenced by anything other than fate. Senator Arya bowed again. We will seek your influence upon the universe as it manifests in drawn lots to determine the vote. A wise solution, unexalted one. She cut the communication. Hesho sighed. They seem very loyal, I noted.
We are trying, Hesho said. This is difficult for us. All my life, I was taught to be very careful in how I expressed my will. But I do not know how to avoid expressing it at all.
He rubbed his temples, his eyes closed.
We must learn the superiority's way, or leave ourselves exposed to be conquered, should the humans ever return. They are my true fear. They attacked us first, during the initial human war. Their leader claimed our shared past made us practically a human colony already. Bah! My fur prickles to even speak the words. We must change to be prepared. But change is difficult. My people are not foolish or weak-willed. It is simply that for many, many centuries, the throne was the one immutable force upon which they could depend. To have it ripped away suddenly is to pull off a bandage before the wound has properly healed.
I found myself nodding, which was silly. It was better that Hesho's rule be replaced. What kind of backward culture still had a hereditary monarchy? A military stratocracy, with the strongest pilots and admirals coming to rule by proving their merits in battle, made far, far more sense. Maybe you don't need to worry so much about the humans, I said to Hesho. I mean, they might not even come back.
Perhaps, Hesho said. I was trained since I was a pup to put the needs of the planet before all else. We spent centuries seeking to recover the Shadow Walkers, but we must face the truth. We will never again have Cytonics among us. We lost that privilege long ago.
He looked to me.
Do not pity me for my loss of authority. Many years ago, my great-great-great-grandfather rode to battle at the head of our armies to fight humankind's invasion. He fought the giants with a sword. Before that, the daimyo of the 17 clans were constantly ready to lead their people in war. But I always fancied this role, being a captain of my own ship. It will be good. So long as my people do not simply vanish into the superiority, like drops of blood in an ocean.
I don't know if it's worth the effort, Hesho, I said, leaning back in my seat. All this work to bend to what they want us to be?
It's either that, or be trapped on our planets with no hyperdrives. My people have tried that, and it is stifling us. The only way to exist with any relevance is to play by the superiority's rules.
And yet, the Dionys and the other primes call themselves the greater races, I said, so proud of how advanced they are, all the while basically enslaving everyone else. Hesho said, but did not reply further. I followed his glance over his shoulder. Then I blushed, seeing that Morimer was sitting right behind him. Scud. When would I learn to think a little before I spoke? Once the weights and measures had docked, Winzik gave leave for the pilots to head off to their shuttles to ride back home for the evening.
Enjoy your day off,
Hesho told me, as the Kitson flew out of our room. Morimer hurried ahead and wouldn't meet my eyes. Great. Well, it wasn't my fault their species was an oppressive group of dictators.
Hey,
Braid said as I collected my bag to leave. I glanced back at her, a little surprised to hear her speak,
Normally, she didn't interact with us after the day's training was done.
Nice work today, she told me. I think this group is finally getting it.
Thanks, I said. That means a lot. Really. She shrugged and brushed past me, out the door, as if embarrassed to have been caught in a moment of sincerity. I just sat in my chair, stunned. Remarkably, it seemed I was making progress with her. Maybe I could do this. Full of newfound determination, I hurried out of the room after the others. I had work to do today. A hero can't pick her own trials. Remember that. As we reached the intersection near the engine room, I took a deep breath, then approached the guard there. MBOT was confident we could put a spy drone together and program it, but once I snuck it onto the ship here, it might take a few minutes to set up. I couldn't exactly do that with the other members of my flight around. The simplest option seemed to be the best. I need to use the restroom, I told the guard, standing watch over the path to engineering. It was a Krell, female, I thought, guessing by the carapace formations along the outside of the small crustacean piloting the armor.
Understood, she answered. I'll send for a drone.
Security on the weights and measures was tight. Though we could walk from the flight docks to our jump room, anywhere else we wanted to go, even if called to meet with command staff, required us to be accompanied by a watchful remote drone, piloted by some security officer. The guard, of course, didn't leave her post. Behind me, Hesho, Kauri, and several other Kitsun waited until I waved them on. Then I peeked past the guard, down the hallway. Could I come up with some way to get information out of the guard while I waited? Hey, I said. How does one get a job in the infantry?
Mine is not a post for lesser species, pilot of starfighters, the guard said, moving her armored hand in several intricate motions. Be glad you are allowed the privilege of training as you do now.
How is it, though? I asked. You have to stand here at this corner basically all the time. Do they at least let you go other places? Maybe,
I'm done with this conversation, she said.
Scud. I was terrible at this part of being a spy. I gritted my teeth, frustrated by my own inability, until a small drone arrived to escort me to the restroom. Our starfighters, of course, had waste reclamation facilities that hooked to our flight suits. We spent hours upon hours of time out there, after all. So far, I hadn't needed to use the facilities on the weights and measures. My heart gave a little leap of excitement as the drone led me past the guard toward the engine room. Unfortunately, we only walked a short distance before turning right into another hallway, one with several bathroom signs on the wall. Like others I'd seen, they were organized along species lines. I was directed to the one that the Dions used, as we had similar enough biology. The drone accompanied me into the bathroom, but not into the stall, so that was good. I tapped my wrist, starting a timer on my hologram bracelet to give us a rough estimate of how long all this would normally take me, then entered the stall, dropped my backpack, and did my business. The drone pilot didn't say anything, though as I washed my hands, I heard them chatting absently with a coworker, their speaker accidentally left on. So perhaps the pilot wouldn't be paying the best of attention. The drone led me back to the hallway, where, surprisingly, I found Hesho still waiting for me, though his crew had all moved on save for Kauri and his servants, who flew on his disc with him. He hovered along beside my head as we continued on toward the shuttle docks.
Is everything well with you, Captain? He asked.
Yeah, just had to hit the restroom.
Ah.
Hesho paused, looking over his shoulder as we flew onward.
They took you down the hallway near the engine room, I see.
Closest bathroom is just to the right.
You didn't get a glimpse into the engine room itself, did you, by chance?
No, didn't go that far.
Pity.
He continued to fly.
I've heard that you have a ship of your own that can hyperjump. Just a rumor, really. Not that you should have to share such information with us.
I eyed him as he hovered along, trying to speak with feigned nonchalance.
Then I found myself smiling. He was trying to figure out if I knew about superiority hyperdrives, but he wasn't any better at this sort of thing than I was. I felt a stab of affection for the furry little dictator. I don't know how their hyperdrives work, Hesho, I said softly as we entered the shuttle hangar. I'm a Cytonic. I can teleport my ship if I have to, but doing so is dangerous. One of the reasons I'm here is so that my people can get access to the superiority's safer technology. Hesho considered that, sharing a look with Kaori. The pickup bay was bustling with activity as pilots were loaded onto shuttles, then sent off to their individual homes on Starsight. The rest of the Kitsen were already boarding a shuttle, but Hesho, after a moment's deliberation, gestured for Kaori to hover his platform closer to my head.
You're a shadow walker, he said. I did not know this.
It's not something I feel comfortable sharing, I said. Not that I mind if you know, it's just weird.
If this doesn't work out,
Hesho said very softly, gesturing toward the hangar bay.
If something goes wrong, visit my people. It has been long since we had shadow walkers among us, but some of their traditions were recorded. Perhaps your people and mine can decipher the superiority technology.
I'll remember that, I said. But I'm still hoping this will work out. Or maybe I'll be able to figure... I cut myself off. Idiot. What are you going to do? Just tell him openly in the middle of an enemy dock that you're trying to figure out how to steal their technology? Hesho, however, seemed to understand.
My people, he said softly, tried stealing superiority technology once. This was decades ago, and is the unspoken reason why we had our citizenship status revoked for a time.
My breath caught, and I couldn't help asking, did it work?
No, Hesho said. My grandmother was queen then, and she coordinated the theft of 3 different superiority ships, all with hyperdrives, at the same moment. All 3, after being stolen, stopped functioning. When my people looked at the spot where the hyperdrives had been, they found only empty boxes.
Like on Embot, I thought.
Superiority hyperdrives, Kaori said, teleport away if stolen, ripping themselves out of the ships and leaving the vessel stranded. It is one of the reasons why, despite centuries passing, the technology remains largely contained.
Hesho nodded.
We found the truth of this the hard way.
Strange, I said. Very strange. Another obstacle to overcome.
I have determined that the best way to help my people is to follow superiority rules, Hesho said. But keep my offer in mind. I feel like we are being used for something in this project. I do not trust Winzik or his department. If you return to your people, let them know of my people. We share a bond, Captain Alanik. Oppression by humans in our past, toys to the superiority in the present. We could be allies.
I appreciate that, I said. You can consider me an ally, Hesho, whatever happens.
We shall share our fate then, as equals.
He smiled a toothy grin.
Save for when we engage the humans in war. Then I get to shoot the first one.
I grimaced.
Ha! I'm going to take that as a promise. Take care, Captain Alanik. We will make it through these odd times together.
Kaori flew him off. And scud, I found myself sincerely wishing I were Alanik. Maybe we could accomplish something together, with the knowledge of Hesho's people, along with my people's fighting skills. Except my people were humans. The very things that frightened him into following the superiority's strict mandates. I felt suddenly exposed, talking like that to Hesho. Sure, the docks were busy, but our conversation had flirted with treason against the superiority. Wouldn't that just be fitting for me? To hide that I was human, but still get arrested as Alanik? What did the air smell like? Grease. Sterile cleaning fluid. Nothing suspicious. I really needed to start sniffing for Vapor's presence before I engaged in suspicious activity. I boarded a shuttle alone this time and flew out along the docks toward the city, where I braced myself for the music of the stars to vanish. Even prepared, I felt a sense of loss as it happened. They minimize wireless communication, but it still happens. They need it to exist. I could understand that. They had to balance fear of the Delvers with the need for societies to communicate. As I was thinking about this, something else struck me. The protesters. They were gone. I'd grown accustomed to seeing the group out here at the edge of the city, holding up signs and complaining about the rights of lesser species. But the area had been cleared of people, though some Dions in brown-striped outfits were cleaning up the refuse left behind by the protesters. What happened? I whispered to Embot. To the protesters.
They struck a deal with the government, Embot said. Compensation to the families of those who died at the testing, and a promise to put more safety protocols in place during any such future tests.
It seemed an anticlimactic ending to the protest, a bureaucratic ending where nothing really changed. But what else had I been expecting? Riots in the streets? I sighed and watched out the back window of the shuttle, my gaze locked on that spot and the working Dions for as long as I could see them. Chapter 27. The next morning, I awoke to find a collection of boxes on the embassy doorstep.
Oh, what's this? Mrs. Chamwit said as I hurriedly gathered them up. Can I help?
No, I said, perhaps too forcefully. It's nothing.
Cleaning drone?
Mrs. Chamwit said as she read the label on one.
Oh.
Her attitude grew visibly subdued as she spoke, continuing her hand signals.
Have I been doing a poor job?
No, I said again, balancing the stack of boxes. Just, I like my privacy, you know?
I see, she said. Well, do you need help setting it up? I've used a few cleaning drones myself in my time.
No, thank you.
I guess I'll be leaving you to enjoy your day off then. I made you a lunch and a dinner in the refrigeration unit.
She stepped out the door.
Thanks, bye,
I said eagerly, shutting it behind her, then carried the boxes up the steps. It was perhaps a little callous, but at the same time, I couldn't have Kuna's spy hanging around finding out what I was doing with this cleaning drone. I hurried to my room, placed the boxes on the bed, and locked the door. Embot, you there? I asked.
Yup, he said, his voice coming through my earpiece. Hold those up for the camera at your workstation so I can confirm that everything came.
I let him inspect the label of every box. Then, at his instructions, I broke them all open and laid out what we'd ordered. A cleaning drone roughly the size of a lunch tray and perhaps 15 centimeters thick. It had its own small acclivity rings under the wings, each no larger than an O made by my thumb and forefinger. This type of drone could fly around a room, dusting shelves and washing windows. It would be virtually silent, moving slowly on its rotating acclivity rings. Embot had also ordered a full set of tools, a large tarp, and some spare parts I could use to affix Embot systems to the drone's chassis. I spent the next 2 hours carefully removing the bottom sections of the drone, the dusting pads, the storage for debris, the cleaning fluid sprays. I left on the drone's little robot arms, but otherwise removed all of its attachments. As I worked, Embot kept me entertained by reading articles for me off the local data net. I was surprised at the extent of things the Superiority let the public read. No military or hyperdrive secrets, of course, but I learned about old Earth. Of particular interest to me was the record of first contact. The first official time humans had met aliens, which had been facilitated by an old telecom company. A thought occurred to me as I worked with some screws, and Embot finished telling me about the history of the Kitson interactions with Earth, which were older but more vague than the first official contact. "Hey," I said, wagging my screwdriver toward Doomslug, who nestled on the tabletop nearby. "Is there anything about slugs like her?"
"You know, I haven't looked," Embot said.
"Let me?"
"Oh."
"Oh, what?"
"The species of molluscoid called Tanix," Embot read, "is a dangerously venomous creature with yellow skin and blue spines, originally from the planet Cambry. They escaped on early trading vessels and are considered an invasive species on several planets. They can be found around various strains of fungi common throughout the galaxy. Report any sightings to authorities immediately and do not touch."
I looked at Doomslug, who trilled questioningly. "Venomous?" I asked.
"That's what it says," Embot said.
"I don't believe it," I said, going back to my work. "Must be a different species from her."
"The pictures look very similar," Embot said. "Maybe they're just not toxic to humans."
Maybe. I thought about that as I finished my work on the drone. With all those pieces removed, it was much lighter, and so should still be able to fly after I attached the spy equipment. I balanced the drone and the tarp and tools under one arm, and Doomslug under the other, and climbed up onto the roof. Then I set everything in Embot's cockpit and plugged the drone into his console.
"All right," he said. "There's plenty of space in the drone's memory. I'm going to wipe it clean and rewrite it with new code. It might take a few minutes. You should climb underneath me and remove the following systems from my hull."
"My hull!"
Doomslug fluted from the seat. Scud. Had Mrs. Chamwit seen her? I couldn't remember. Embot projected a set of schematics for me, highlighting certain systems. I nodded, then climbed out and draped the tarp over him, tying it down to the launch pad. "Has Mrs. Chamwit seen Doomslug?" I asked. "As far as you know?"
"I couldn't say," Embot said. "Usually the slug lives in your room or my cockpit, places where you've asked Mrs. Chamwit not to clean."
"Yeah, but Doomslug rarely stays where I put her, and I suspect Mrs. Chamwit is looking for things to report, so keeping an invasive species as a pet could get me into trouble."
"I still think you're too harsh on Mrs. Chamwit. I like her. She's nice."
"Too nice," I said.
"Is that possible?"
"Yes, particularly if you're a Krell. Don't forget what those creatures did and are currently doing to our people back on Detritus."
"I am incapable of forgetting things."
"Yeah?" I asked. "Exactly how much of your life from before meeting me do you remember?"
"That's different," he said. "Anyway, we just got another message from Kuna, who wants an update on your experiences with flight training. Shall I send them another bland description of the day's exercises?"
"Yes. Leave out the personal interactions."
"You're going to have to talk to them eventually."
"Not if I escape with a hyperdrive first," I said, securing the last of the tarp's corners. I didn't want to deal with Kuna and their creepy smile. That alien knew more than they were saying, and I figured stalling was the best way to not get caught in whatever nets Kuna was weaving. I grabbed the tools and climbed down underneath Embot to begin working. He helpfully projected the schematics I needed onto the underside of his fuselage so I could follow the instructions step by step. As I undid the first access panel, I suddenly had a flashback to working alone in the cave on Detritus, trying to get Embot to power on for the first time. Strange how fondly I looked back on that time. The excitement of being in flight school, the challenge of rebuilding my own ship. It had been such a satisfying, wonderful time of my life. Though, thinking of it, I couldn't help but be reminded of my friends. It hadn't yet been 2 weeks, but it felt like an eternity since I'd heard Ned poke fun at Arturo or listened to one of Kimmelin's made-up sayings. I was here for them, and everyone else on Detritus. With that in mind, I started poking around Embot's insides.
Most of the wires here had been carefully tied off, organized, and labeled by Raj during Embot's rebuilding. My friend did good work, and I quickly located the systems I needed to remove. All right, I said, tapping a box with my wrench. This is one of your holographic units. Once I pull this out, a good quarter of you will turn back into looking like yourself. You ready for that?
Actually, no, he said. I'm a little nervous.
Can you get nervous?
I'm trying to do what you told me, Embot said. Claim my emotions as my own, not just simulations. And I'm nervous. What if someone sees me?
That's why we have the tarp. And we need this unit. Otherwise, the drone will be too visible to explore.
All right, Embot said. I guess this was kind of my idea. It is a good idea, right?
Ask me once we succeed, I said. Then took a deep breath and unhooked the small holographic projector, which had a built-in processor for active camouflage. Larger and more advanced than my bracelet, it should still fit in the drone.
I feel exposed, Embot said. Naked. Is this what being naked feels like?
Similar, I guess. How's that programming going?
Well, Embot said, this drone will have fewer constraints than I will. I'm not going to copy over the code that forbids me from flying myself, for example. It will be like me, only better.
That gave me pause. You're going to give it a personality?
Of course, Embot said. I want the best for my child.
Child, Scud. I hadn't realized. Is that how you view it? I asked.
Yes, it will be my...
Click, 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 click. I frowned as I stowed the holographic unit to the side, then started working on taking out the other components we'd need.
I'm back, Embot eventually said. Spensa, that watchdog subroutine forbids me to copy myself. I find it distressing.
Can you code the drone, but not with a personality?
Maybe, Embot said. This subroutine is extensive. Apparently, someone was very scared of the possibility of me creating my own...
Click, 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 click. Scud, I said, ripping out one of Embot's sensor modules and putting it beside the holographic unit.
Embot?
I had to wait a full 5 minutes for the reboot, longer than previous times, long enough that I started to worry we'd broken something permanent inside him.
I'm back, he said, causing me to let out a breath in relief. I see you have my backup sensor module. That's good. Now we just need my frequency jammer, and we should be in good shape.
I pulled myself underneath him to another hatch, which I undid. Can we talk about what's happening to you without causing it again?
I don't know, he said softly. I'm frightened. I don't like being frightened.
I'm sure whatever is wrong with your programming, we can fix it, I said. Eventually.
That's not what makes me afraid. Spensa, have you thought about why my programming has all these rules? I can't fly on my own, except for the most basic repositioning. I can't fire my weapons. I don't even have the pathway connections to do that. I can't copy myself, and my programming is thrown into a recursive stalling loop if I think about trying to...
Click, 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 click. I worked quietly while he rebooted yet again.
I'm back, he finally said. That's getting very frustrating. Why did they make this so hard?
I guess that whoever programmed you was just very careful, I said, trying not to say anything that would send him into another shutdown.
Careful of what? Spensa, the more I examine it, the more my brain looks like a cage. Whoever built me wasn't being careful, they were being paranoid. They were afraid of me.
I'm not particularly afraid of water, I said, but I'd still seal up my pipes tightly if I'm building a sewer system.
It's not the same, Embot said. The pattern here is obvious. My creators, my old pilot, Commander Spears, must have been truly afraid of me to put these prohibitions in place.
It might not have been him, I said. Maybe these rules are just the result of some ultra-cautious bureaucrats. And remember, powerful AIs are somehow connected to the Delvers. You're supposed to anger them. It might not have been you that anyone was afraid of. It might have been the dangers you could bring.
Still, Embot said. Spensa, what about you? Are you afraid of me?
Of course not.
Would you be if I could fire my own weapons, fly myself around, copy myself at will? One Embot is your friend, but what about 1,000 of us? 10,000? I've been researching old Earth media. They certainly seemed frightened of the idea. Would you fear us if I became an army?
I had to admit it made me hesitate. I imagined that thought, turning it over in my head.
You told a story, Embot said, about a shadow who took the place of the man who had created him.
I remember.
What if I'm the shadow, Spensa? Embot said. What if I'm the thing from the darkness that tries to imitate men? What if I can't be trusted? What if—
No, I said, firmly cutting him off. I trust you. So why wouldn't I trust you 1,000 times over? I think we could do far worse than having a fleet of Embots on our side. It might get a little strange to talk to you all, but, well, my life isn't exactly normal these days anyway.
With all the proper parts removed, I scooted out from under Embot and rested my hand on his tarped over wing.
You're not some dangerous shadow of a person, Embot. You're my friend.
As I am a robot, your physical